and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are in your ears thanks to the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. So we've got no real Albion action to report this week due to the international break, so we thought we'd have a chat with a real football legend. In a career that took in Spurs, Watford, Real Menorca, West Brom and the Albion, and scored one of the most memorable goals in World Cup history, particularly if you're Irish. And he also went on to have an amazing media career, including being an expert on Spanish football. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Jerry Armstrong.
Hi, Eddie.
Hi, Jerry, thank you so much for joining us. Obviously, we're going to get into the nuts and bolts of your career and everything football with you shortly. But first, we just need to point out that myself and Alan, next Sunday, actually this Sunday, Al, we will be live at the Hope and Ruin, the pub on Queen's Road in Brighton.
It's going to be a bit late if you're listening to this a week after we've recorded this. But yes, so Sunday the 17th of September, we are at the Hope and Ruin pub on Queen's Road in Brighton. We're going to have our Reverbathon. Now, as we said before many times, Radio Reverb is a community radio station. It's not a public broadcast station and it's not a commercial radio station. It cannot accept advertising. We can only get funding from sponsorship, donations and grants. So to that end, we're asking you to stick your hand in your pocket for a few shekels and help keep this brilliant community project going. It got its full license actually in 2007, having had a couple of trial runs in 2004. Since then, it's been in various locations around the city. It currently resides in the open market. But we've got to pay our various bills, our rent, our rates. We've got to pay for licenses. So every time you hear an outro, believe it or not, we have to pay for that. So anything you can do to help us, come along to the Reverbathon. Our slot is at midday at the Hope and Ruin in Queen's Road. Or you can just go to radioreverb.com/donate, hit that button and throw us a few quid in that way. But if you are about on Sunday, having got back from Old Trafford the previous day, or if you're just in the vicinity, do pop in, come and heckle us. And if your heckling's that good, you can come and join us on air. So see you on Sunday at the Hope and Ruin.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it already. It'll be fabulous. What I'm also looking forward to is having a chat to this fella here called Jerry Armstrong. Now, Jerry, obviously, you've had a very long and very distinguished career. You've been in football for a long time. But let's go right back to the beginning. And growing up in Belfast, it can't have been easy.
It was difficult in Belfast right through the 60s and 70s. The troubles were really bad. It was difficult to get to do any sort of sport. But my sport at the time was Gaelic football and hurling. I didn't play soccer until I was 16, 17. And that came about because I got a ban for fighting. And I was suspended for about 6 weeks.
Now, and, I read about this. Now, basically, it's a tough sport. I mean, it seems to be a recurring thing throughout your career, actually, really, doesn't it? We'll get to Southwick later.
Charming.
But I mean, obviously, you would obviously playing the traditional Irish sports was an escape. But you didn't have all the equipment, didn't you? So you didn't have the helmets, and you didn't have a lot of the official equipment.
No, it was just a hurling stick, and you had to be brave. You had to put your head and your hands and your arms and everything in, and be prepared to get a whack or two. And the Gaelic was the same. It was very rough and ready, but there were great sports when you're competing 15 against 15. And, you know, it was a physical game, but it got me strong and it got me, you know, fit. And then I loved playing soccer in the street. I was a big Leeds United fan as a kid. I supported them from when I was about 7 years of age. And I started playing at 16, 17. I started playing some of the Churches League, you know, there was the Down and Connor League. And I played there on one season. The first season I was there, I scored 30 odd goals. And then I got an opportunity to go and do a trial with Bangor Football Club. And I went to Bangor and unfortunately, my first game at Bangor, I came on as a sub because it was a semi-final. The lads had got to the semi-final. I'd only just joined the club and trained two nights with them on the Tuesday and the Thursday. And I was suspended from the Gaelic at the time, but I started playing the soccer. So it was one of those where I was desperate to get on and play. I was full of energy and power. And it was 1-1 in the game with 15 minutes to go. And Ralph McGugin was our manager. And he said, "Jerry, come on, I need a goal, big man. On you go." So I came on. And within a couple of minutes, I got the ball and went past a couple of people. And then the big centre half, as I went past him, he tried to cut me in two around the knees. And I kept going, had the shot. The keeper saved it. The ball came out. One of my teammates' rebound came to him. He put it in the net. And that was, I thought that was it, 2-1. And jogging back the halfway line, the centre half threatened me and said, "You go past me again, I'm going to break your legs." So obviously he said the wrong thing. But a couple of minutes later, I picked the ball up and he wasn't going to stop me. There was two or three of them that tried to stop me and went past him again and had the shot. And the ball flew into the back of the net. And I put a 3-1 up, and it was on about 5 or 6 minutes. And I remember turning to jog back, and the big guy came running over towards me. And I didn't wait for him to hit me. I hit him first. It was right hook. And like I said, oh, that was my first game at soccer for Bangor Football Club. So it lasted about 6.5 minutes. But the manager was a really...
It's nice how there's a level of consistency about your attitude to sport, isn't there? Actually, I just wanted to say this. You said you didn't start playing football till you were 15, 16, 17. So, and you mentioned, obviously, at the top of your segment there about sort of the issues that growing up in Northern Ireland was in the 60s and 70s. But can you just give us a flavour of the cultural influence that George Best would have had in Northern Ireland?
I mean, everybody loved George Best. And even if you weren't a Manchester United fan, you were a George Best fan. And he played for Northern Ireland. He did things that no one else did. And he was charismatic. You know, Manchester United were a great team then. They were winning Europa, the European Cups. And he was a star man. But little did I know that in a few years' time, I would be playing alongside him and would look upon him as a teammate and a friend. But football's crazy, and you know my career was crazy as well, the way it worked out. You know, and I got suspended, obviously. I couldn't play in the final of the game. The manager brought me in, Bertie Neal, and he said, "Listen, big man, you know, you've got potential here. You know," he said, "you're a rough diamond." He said, "If you listen to me, I can help you." So I listened to him for the next 3 years, and I became a striker in the first team at Bangor, and I did well. And then obviously Arsenal and Tottenham came in to try and sign me. And Arsenal probably made more progress, I thought, than Tottenham. But Tottenham offered me a chance to come over on trial for 4 or 5 days. And myself and another guy called Johnny Jemison went over on trial. And I played a game for the reserves against the RAF. And we beat them 3-1 and scored a couple of goals. And then I never heard nothing for over a month. And I thought that was it. That obviously they didn't think it was good enough. But the negotiations was going on in the background, little that I know. And a few weeks later, I was told that I was signing for Spurs on a Sunday morning. I went and met Terry Neal and signed for Spurs. And the rest is all history. I moved over to Tottenham in 1975.
I mean, that's a kind of a bizarre thing, isn't it, really? I mean, because by this time you'd left your teens, and yet it seems that just about everyone else seemed to have your future in their hands, as opposed to probably nowadays where the players have a lot more power. And even a teenager can actually decide where he's going. But if a club wants him, he can go there, rather than if two clubs are going, it's decided for him. So did you have any say in it, or did you sort of have one preference over the other when it was Arsenal and Spurs fighting over you? Or was it a case of, right, you're going there? I mean, did you know of a better pathway to the first team? How did it feel for you at the time? Or were you really kept in the dark?
Well, you're guided by the people that you're working with. And I mean, he was my mentor. Bertie Neal was the manager. And he kept me informed. Whenever clubs come to watch me, Coventry, Liverpool, you know, he told me that, you know, there's scouts here today watching you from Liverpool or Coventry or Tottenham or Arsenal. Mm. But Arsenal did come quite a lot. Tottenham was the first club to really make contact with me. I think I went over, I think about 8 or 9 months before I actually moved, we went over to England and played a few games over there against like Fleetwoods and teams like that. But we played Shrewsbury, who were a decent side. Mm, and I played really well against Shrewsbury. Yeah, so they made an offer of £7,000 or £8,000 to try and sign me. And that was turned down by the club. So I knew there was other clubs and they were making inroads. And I just trusted them to do what was right for me and for the club. And it worked out.
Yeah. Spurs didn't always see you as a striker, though, did they?
No, that was a problem. I mean, the first couple of years, I was a striker, and I was enjoying it. But I got myself to another level of fitness, and obviously, I worked on my skill and technique. And every afternoon, I was in the gym with the Noel Brotherstons, and I mean, there was a young 16-year-old called Glenn Hoddle who was like doing his tricks, and I was thinking, 16, he's only 16, and look what he can do with both feet. I mean, it makes you stand back and go, wow, I'm never going to be that good. You're never going to be as a... But then I realized that I had other attributes that Glenn Hoddle didn't have. You know, I had the pace and the power and the attitude and determination, and I put my head in where other people wouldn't, and I put my foot in where other people wouldn't. So that sort of thing started to come across. But it was quite daunting at start, because I was sort of thinking, I'd never obviously been to England before and lived there, and you have to sort of settle in. And I really did enjoy it. I have to say, it was great everyday training. That was something I loved doing, and I got fitter. But about 6 months later, I got a call up for the international team. There was a few players that pulled out. It was a friendly match between Israel and Northern Ireland. The manager was Dave Clements, and Terry Neal had recommended that I was doing really well in the reserves, and he said bring him along for experience. So he did, and I really enjoyed that as well. And that was the time that Pat Jennings won the PFA Player of the Year award.
Sure.
And he came in, and obviously Tottenham being a big Jewish club, there was, you know, we were really looked after well, I have to say. We really looked after and really enjoyed it. And that was the first time that I got to meet other international players. George Best wasn't in the squad then, but several months later when I did get brought back into the squad again, I played in the first team. George Best was in the squad, and we were playing West Germany, who were world champions in 1977. They were the world champions, and Danny Blanchflower was the manager, and he called me the night before and said, right, I'm going to play you tomorrow up front. You're going to make your debut against the world champions, West Germany. He says, I'm playing you up front with George Best. Well, that's it, isn't it? You know, you're playing up front with your boyhood hero, and you're playing against the world champions. It doesn't, you're making your debut for your country. It doesn't get better than that, I have to say.
It doesn't get better than that. But I mean, you played, what, 84 times, I think it was, for Spurs before Watford came in for you. Watford weren't in first division at the time.
AD, yeah. Can I just go back a bit here? Because I think need to add some historical context to this. Is that obviously Spurs were one of the big sides in the 1960s. But at the time, if you're saying 1975, you joined a Spurs side that probably wasn't, certainly in post-war terms, wasn't at its best, was it? I mean, What happened there? Because a lot of people obviously, you know, probably don't necessarily realise Spurs actually got relegated for a season.
Yeah.
What happened there?
I have a theory about that, because 1976-77 season, that was the season I made my debut in the First Division, which is the old Premier League. And the First Division, I played away to Ipswich. And it was a tough game. You know, Alan Hunter was the centre half, and Kevin Beattie, two very good defenders, and they were a great side. They had a great side. So I remember playing that, and it was exciting for me, and I was still learning. And so was Alexa Glenn Hoddle and the Steve Walfords. And there was a lot of young players were getting opportunities, because Spurs went on a world tour at the end of the season. And we went on a world tour, and it lasted about 5 weeks. We went to Canada and played in Toronto against the Toronto Metros. Eusebio was playing for them. We won the match. Then we went down to Los Angeles, and then flew over to Hawaii, and then Fiji. And then we played a game in Fiji, stayed for 2 or 3 days, then went to Wellington and did 2-3 days there, and then Auckland, and kept playing games all the time. Over to Australia and Adelaide, Melbourne and Sydney, we did loads of games there as well. And, you know, we got back after the 5 weeks via India, and it was quite daunting, to be honest, playing 9 matches. And we came back, we had about, I think, 10 or 11 days off before we started back pre-season training. And that's the season that, and we had 2 or 3 players got injuries, cartilage injuries. Don McAllister was one of them who picked up a cartilage, and Jimmy Holmes was the other one. And players were feeling really fatigued. And because of the injuries, I got probably more games than I should have done at the start. And Glenn Hoddle and people like that, and Neil McNabb, we were all thrown in at the deep end and given the opportunity, which was great for us, but not great in terms of results. So that was the season Tottenham got relegated. And they actually went backwards first. But then the following season, we came straight back up again.
Yep.
And it was a great season. I'm going to tell you, it was a great season. I'll tell you why. The team that really pushed us all the way, because Bolton and ourselves and Southampton went up, but Brighton were right there. They were right in the midst of it all. And they really, I think they beat us when we went down to the Goldstone.
Go on, Al. Yeah. I know what's coming.
You know exactly what's coming. I've got to be very diplomatic here and very careful. And you do appreciate, Jerry, I'm expressing this specifically from a Brighton fan's point of view. But when it came to the last day of the season, there was only 2 points for a win in those days.
That's correct.
We had to play Blackpool and win, and we did. It was in front of 34,000 people. Spurs and Southampton only needed a point, which they got, playing each other. And now I'm saying nothing, I'm implying nothing. But was it an exciting game to play in?
No, because there was tension. And I think Southampton, and Alan Ball was the captain, he was sort of frightened, one, that they would mess up and maybe lose. And we were the same. We didn't want to lose. So it's one of those, we were quite negative. Both teams were quite negative. But there was chances in the game. And the best chance fell to Chris Nicol, who's the big centre-half who played for Northern Ireland. And I remember him fluffing his lines about 3 yards out, hitting one over the crossbar. And knowing Chris was trying to score, but he just missed it. But
all his teammates were telling him not to afterwards, weren't they? Saying, don't do that!
Well, I remember getting the ball on the halfway line and running against Chris. And I was quite quick and strong at the time, and being told to go to the corner flag because there was maybe 2 or 3 minutes to go, that sort of stuff. So you knew there was a bit of desperation, but there was also fear that you would lose. So both teams were happy with the draw, let's say.
When you say there was 2 and 3 minutes to go, you mean there was 23 minutes to go, right?
Yeah. To be fair, I mean, at the end of that game, AD, at the end of the Brighton game, it was you have to remember that it was our best ever season, like we've just had last season. It was our best ever season. We'd never finished so high, fourth in the old second division in what is now the Championship. And Alan Mullery said something. Now, you could say it was chutzpah. I would say it's actually a silly thing to say, but he said, I promise you will get promotion next year. Now, no manager can make that promise. The fact he delivered on it was probably part of who he was. But, yes, we missed out. But I think it just gave us... It's a bit like 2016-17. We missed out against Middlesbrough with that one-all draw when, it could have been a win either way. So there's the parallels are fascinating. But the following year, we then get promotion with 4 games to go. Look at it. It's exactly... The parallels are kind of frightening. The team just needed that extra year in order to regroup and improve and go that extra mile over the line.
A bit like when we missed out under Chris Hughton and then got promotion.
That's exactly what I've just said.
Okay, but we're gonna come back and talk about Mullers very, very shortly. But, I mean, you did get the move to Watford, and you've been very vocal in how influential Graham Taylor was on your career.
Yeah, I had to move to Watford in the end because Tottenham started playing me. You were asking earlier, Eddie, about... playing different positions. They played me, and there was only one sub then. I was playing at right back. I played centre-half, a lot of games at centre-half for Tottenham. And, they had me playing there. So Keith Bergenshaw said I was the best centre-half at the club, and that's where he wanted me to play. But then, one week I was playing against Stoke in the second division and scored twice against them. We won 3-1. Then I went and played my first home game at Windsor Park against Belgium in a World Cup. And I played up front and scored 2 goals for Northern Ireland against Belgium. Then I came back on the Friday and went into training. John Dungan was fit again, so he was first choice striker. And I thought, question mark for Keith Bergenshaw, what's he going to do? And Keith didn't even put me on the bench in that game. He let me go to play for the reserves at Bristol City, where I played at centre-half. So that was the problem. So I wanted to move.
Positionally, what was your preference?
Centre-forward, I wanted to be up front where the action was. I could play centre-half all day long. I played a lot of games. Listen, I'll tell you, I played a lot of games at Brighton as a centre-half.
Yeah.
A lot of games at Brighton. When I was coaching the reserves, played a lot of games. And Steve Gadding and the boys used to have a lot of fun, but there was very few people ever got past me.
That's a bizarre thing. I mean, I mean, we'll come to obviously your time at the Albion in the second half of the show, but I, to be fair, I only remember you as a forward player. I've got to say, I mean, it's probably just, you know, my memory playing tricks on me, but I've only ever sort of considered you as a centre forward. But, you know, hey, Steve Foster started his career as a centre forward and made a living out of it as a centre back. So, you know, them's the
very
breaks.
Common.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Adam Virgo.
Well, to be fair, he won accolades on the back of that. But so tell us about Graham Taylor.
Yeah, Graham Taylor was the manager who had been chasing me for about 18 months, and eventually Tottenham reluctantly let me go. And, you know, which I was pleased in the end that Keith had decided to let me go. I could have stayed on at Tottenham and played and got maybe 15, 20, 25 games every season, but playing in different positions as a utility player. But I went to Watford, and Watford was obviously in the second division, and they were in the bottom three or four, had a couple of games in hand. Myself, Pat Rice, joined it the same week, and so did Les Taylor from Oxford. So those were the three players, and we were a good outfit, and we kept ourselves middle of the table for the rest of that season. And then the following year, we trained really hard. I mean, Watford's probably the hardest club I've ever been at with in terms of physical training, morning, noon and night. We would train sometimes, you know, we train at 6 o'clock in the morning when you went away to Scandinavia, and then you'd go and do physical exercise for another hour and a half, about 10:30. You'd have your lunch, and then you'd go and have another one in the afternoon or evening. So we had like three sessions a day. It was hard going. So we were physically, I would say, the fittest team in the league when I was there in 1980, 81. But my fitness level and I was learning, still learning to be a player and a striker. And I was playing regularly up front for Northern Ireland. And we were having a great campaign with Portugal, Sweden and Israel. And of course, Scotland. They were the favourites in the group. We already beat Sweden 3-0 our opening game. We lost 1-0 to Portugal, but then we beat them 1-0 in Windsor Park. And Israel we drew away with. And then we obviously beat Israel in the final game to qualify. We drew with Scotland home and away, which was great results. So we qualified for the World Cup. And at the same year that Watford obviously got promotion. And we got promotion. And that was a big, big song and dance with Elton John being the chairman and everything. That was fun, a lot of fun.
Yeah, I heard that the esteemed Watford chairman liked to invite the players around to his house for a little soiree every now and then. Yeah. Very quiet affairs, I believe.
Fantastic. You know, what a club and what a chairman to have. He used to have a party every Sunday before the season kicked off. So we would play like the Saturday, you'd play a game, and then the Sunday morning, everybody would meet at the club, and it was a convoy to head to his house in Windsor. Well, it wasn't a house. It was like Buckingham Palace, you know. But, you know, we'd go to his place. And you'd have, you had to have
a palace really for a queen.
had the special passes to get in through the security. And but it wasn't just players and their families. It was the ground staff and the people who worked in the office. I mean, everybody was...
Everyone at Watford.
Club atmosphere. And that's what I loved about Graham Taylor. Everybody was treated the same. And he had stuff in the contract about when you sign your contract at Watford, you had to allow for 14 or 15 days that you would give to charity every year with the club. And they'd have you at hospitals and they'd have you doing stuff, all community work, which is great. I think that's something that a lot of football clubs could take a leaf out of their book.
Well, that's something I specifically remember from. I mean, you know, when one thinks of football in England in the sort of late 70s into the 80s, you know, there was a lot of problems on the terraces, you know, the attendances were dwindling, you know, big clubs were just getting sort of four figures in terms of, and there was a lot of stuff. And I think that some people just sort of took the mickey out of it a little bit, but you now get to see sort of 30, 35, 40 years on with that hindsight, just how progressive and imaginative Watford were. I mean, we look back and say, oh, it's a family club. You know, they invite kids to do this. And, you know, the chant used to go up, we're going to nick your sweets and lollipops. But you look on that with hindsight now, you look at that with a revisionist, with a retrospective consideration. They were at the vanguard of something that everyone is actually now doing. So it's not just about the fact that, well, the sounds thing, what you're saying here, Jerry, is not just the family aspect. It's just the fact that everyone at the club, from the chairman down to the tea lady. I mean, the tea lady is obviously very important, but you know, everyone at the club was basically a member of what sounded like a very special elite group.
Yeah, and that's been continued, like with Luther Blissett and the players, John Barnes. You know, the players go to different clubs. Luther went off to Italy and came back to Watford, and Barnes, he goes off to Liverpool. I went off to Spain. But the players, we all kept together, that association. And still to this day, there's about 180-odd members in the association, which is something that Graham Taylor wanted to continue. And he had a big impact on any of the players who went to Watford. He had a big impact on your life.
I don't know if you remember the lady's name, but I think it was when we played there last season, or last time we played.
Oh, she had a stand named after her, didn't she?
It was the lady who, perhaps you can remind me of her name, but it was as a lady.
Anne something, I think.
It's Anne, yeah. That's right. Anne's been there from day dot. She used to look after all the kids in the paddock in front. And as the players used to come out the tunnel, on the right-hand side is where all the kids were put. And she looked after them all for an eternity, and she's like part of the furniture. You know, she's such an important lady.
And I'm not part of the Watford setup in any way, shape or form, but it happened to be, they announced it on the day that we played there, and we were in the press box, and it was a genuine onion chopping moment when they actually said, unbeknownst to her, that actually, right, you know, we were giving this certificate, we're giving it, thank you very much. By the way, that stand behind the goal there is going to be named after, and you think, wow, just exactly. Wow.
Yeah, no, she was a smashing lady. She's a good girl.
You can't think of it in those terms.
Okay, listen, well,
go on. It sounds like that the early 80s were very much your high times. Like I say, you got promoted with Watford. You know, Northern Ireland were punching above their weight, certainly on the international scene. But one story, and I remember this, AD, and I don't know if you recall this, but and perhaps Jerry could to confirm it, but I doubt what's the name of the Football Association in Northern Ireland? Is it the IFA,
isn't it?
The Irish Football Association.
The Irish Football Association. Yeah. I'm not sure that they necessarily had the funds. So just remind us where it was you did your heat training for the 82 World Cup.
We went to Sussex University. We stayed in the Metropole Hotel for 2 weeks, had a brilliant training sessions in the heat. It was a real hot spell. And the preparation was perfect. We loved it. That was my first time really spending a long time down in Brighton. And it was great. Good old Sussex by the sea.
Okay, well, we're going to come and talk to Jerry about that 82 Cup World Cup very, very shortly. But first, you're listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com on DAB, and of course on our podcast. As ever, this show is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And Phil has given us another lovely shirt for us to look at. Did you see the shirt there, Jerry?
I did. I'm not sure about the colour.
do you know anything about that particular jersey, do you think?
Should he?
I've seen it. I thought when you had it on the screen earlier, and I thought, is that a kit? Is that the away kit?
Well, you tell me.
I haven't a clue, but it was a strange colour, I have to say.
The thing is, AD, I don't know, but I mean, I'm going to try and describe it. It's kind of yellow and white, and I'd say the yellow is a mustardy yellow.
It's
impossible to describe the pattern. So let's just say it's mostly white in the middle and then mostly yellow at the top and bottom and on the sleeves with some kind of what looks like, I suppose, razor-type pattern. It's sponsored by Philishave. It's the badge that caught my eye initially because basically it's a blue badge with what looks like, as they would say, a swooping seagull. Now, the first thing that sprung to mind, and then I saw how badly the badge had been photoshopped, was Western Supermare, because they are also called the seagulls. But then something at the back of my mind seems to make me think that, and if you're saying that Jerry ought to know this, I'm just wondering, this isn't Bangor, is it?
Yes, it is.
Wow.
Is it Bangor?
Yes.
Wow.
You don't recognise the badge.
Don't forget there's two Bangors. There's one in Wales as well as the one in Northern Ireland that I played for.
I assume this is the Bangor in Northern Ireland.
Yeah,
I hope so.
So where did you get the shirt from? Where did you get the photograph?
So okay, basically, so just... this is from our sponsor, oldfootballshirts.com, where there's over 130,000 shirts, pictures of shirts from all over the world, from pretty much every single club. It's been translated into 7 different languages. And it's just basically, it's an online gallery of football shirts. And
you reckon the world's biggest, like I say, 130,000. Basically, people take a picture of their shirt and post it on there. It's as simple as that. And it's gained traction around the world. People actually wanting to buy shirts, thinking it's a huge shop. It isn't. It's merely a gallery. So, yes, somewhere down the line, a Bangor fan has actually posted this. And Adrian Packham, my co-host here, is about to tell us all about it.
I am, Mr. Wares, indeed. This is your shirt of the week, says Phil. This is the 1993 to 95 home shirt of Northern Ireland Championship side Bangor FC. Nicknamed the Seasiders, they were formed in 1918 and play their home games at Clandeboy Park, which has a capacity of 1,895. The club joined the league in 1927 and had their heyday in the 90s. And in 1992, they finished second in the league and qualified for European football for the very first time. The following season, they went on to win not only the Irish Cup, but the Irish League Cup too. The club's downfall began in 2008. After joining the inaugural IFA Premiership, they did not apply for a licence for the 2009 to 2010 season, citing financial issues and low attendances. They've struggled ever since, really, plunging to the depths of the Ballymena and Provincial and Intermediate League, fourth tier, at the end of the 16-17 season. The following season, they won 27 of their 28 matches to ensure promotion back to the Football League. And last season, they gained promotion to the Championship after winning the Premier Intermediate League. I've had a couple of links to the Albion. Your guest today, Jerry Armstrong, was with, who was with us between 86 to 89, playing 55 times and scoring, he says, 6 here. I think it was 7 league goals, actually, Phil. Jerry began his career in Northern Ireland with St Paul's Swifts, Cromack Albion, and Bangor before his move to England, which started at Spurs. Another to have worn both kits is Paul Byrne, who after unsuccessfully trying to break into the Arsenal team of 1991, turned his back on England and joined Bangor for the 91 to 93 seasons, finishing his time there with a winning goal in the Irish Cup final before removed to Celtic under Liam Brady. Paul joined the Albion on loan in 95, playing 8 times and scoring once. And the following season, he signed for Southend. So thank you for that, Phil. And like I said, you can see that and over 130,000 other very shirts good over at oldfootballshirts.com.
Can I just say, I have absolutely no recollection of this Paul Byrne whatsoever. Apart, the only one I can think of is the fellow we call the Canadian, who was for a while a marketing manager. Went while we, you know, just after we got to the Amex.
Different spelling.
Even so, I cannot for the life of me remember. Do you remember him?
No,
I've seen him play. He's a good player. He was a very good footballer.
But there you go.
You've just shown us up, Jeff. Well, you would do, but you know, you've just shown us up.
Okay. of all the things that you're probably best known for, Jerry, it would be the 1982 World Cup, probably, where certainly in my mind's eye, I was having a chat with you the other day, and I admitted to you that you scoring against Spain was probably one of my first footballing memories that I can actually remember vividly, and that was you scoring that winning goal against Spain. I mean, it was quite the World Cup for you, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, nobody gave us a chance. I remember Jimmy Greaves and Satan Greaves, who were on the show a few weeks before we went to the World Cup and said, you know, good luck Northern Ireland. We didn't have a particularly good British championship because we were preparing, obviously, for the World Cup. And he didn't think we'd score a goal. He didn't think we'd get a point and, you know, we wouldn't be there too long. So we went across and obviously we drew with Yugoslavia, we then drew with Honduras, and then we beat Spain to win the group and qualify.
Who scored that goal against Honduras, Jerry?
Yeah, I scored the first goal. That was my first goal in the World Cup against Honduras, and then I scored again, obviously, against Spain.
And France. I think you scored against France as well.
I scored against France in the quarterfinals. That was my final game in the 82 World Cup against France. And Michel Platini came over and said, Jerry, could you swap shirts with me afterwards?
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
one of those. Like.
Yeah, sling your rook, Michel, you know, just going to football admin. But actually, given that, and this is one of my, well, I'll say one of my, I do remember the 78 World Cup, but my point would be is, obviously Spain were hosts. At the time, they were certainly considered the perennial underachievers and did do until about 2010. But this was Spain at home. I think the game we're talking about is in the Bernabeu. But given that, sorry to say this, that that match was closer to the end of World War II than it was today. So certainly for our younger listeners, talk us through the goal that beat the hosts.
We were under the cosh. We hadn't had too many opportunities. It was a physical game. Spain were getting frustrated because the opening 15, 20 minutes, they didn't really penetrate. And we hung on till halftime and we were quite content. And frustration was creeping in with the Spaniards. And the second half started. And I was playing on the right side of midfield because we had brought in a young footballer called Norman Whiteside to make his debut for Northern Ireland. He became the youngest footballer ever to play in the World Cup. And he played up front with Billy Hamilton, and I played the right side of midfield and give a bit of protection in front of Jimmy Nicol. And I won the ball just outside my own penalty area at the start of the second half, and I went on a run for maybe, I don't know, 40 or 50 yards. And Xabi Alonso's father, Perico, was trying to kick me, but he couldn't catch me. So I managed to play the ball out wide to Billy Hamilton, who took on the centre half at the time, who played for Valencia in Spain. His name was Tendillo. And Billy went past him and put in a fantastic cross, probably the best cross he's ever put in his life. And the so-called best goalkeeper in Europe was Arconada, and he decided to come for it. He flapped it, pushed it straight out towards me coming into the penalty area. And I hit it hard and low through his legs and Alasanko's legs. That was the other centre half. And it hit the back of the net, and that was the only goal of the game.
I mean, we're talking probably, what, midway through the second half here? I guess the rest of the second half must have taken ages to get through then.
You were down to 10 minutes as well, weren't you?
It was the second minute into the second half. It was 47, 48 minutes on the clock.
I didn't even realise it was that early.
Yeah, and then 7 or 8 minutes after that, Mal Donaghy was sent off for nothing for a push, you know. And Camacho didn't really ask for anything, but the South American Paraguayan officials sent Mal Donaghy off, so it reduced us to 10 men. Yeah. So we played the last 30-odd minutes with 10 men, and we still managed to beat the Spaniards.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, to win things, you've got, and to be successful, you've got to have good players on the pitch. But having a good mentality and team spirit around the place, obviously that can add an awful lot as well. And actually, Sammy McElroy said this about you. He said, the team we had, Protestant, Catholic, it didn't matter, because when we got together, we had sing-songs, we had a good time. We all stuck together off the pitch, on the pitch. We never talked about anything political. We just talked about the game and what was happening in your life and at your club. And Big Jerry Armstrong, wow, he was the band leader. Before you asked anyone to sing, Big Jerry was on the second verse.
Is that He's true? How much of that is true?
Yeah, it's quite true, because I used to organise the sing songs after the game, and we stayed in the Culloden Hotel in Belfast for many, many years, and they used to close the bar at 11:30. That was last hours, and then 11:45 it reopened again. And, you know, but the crazy thing was, in those days, you know, I just played a game on a Wednesday night, but I still had to fly back on Thursday to train for Watford. Graham Taylor wouldn't give me the day off. So I used to stay up till maybe 5 or 6 in the morning, jump on a taxi to go to the airport and go straight to the training ground without any sleep, and haven't played the night before. So that was all part and parcel of the fun. And it was a camaraderie. As Sammy said, we were a band of brothers and they had this great camaraderie. And then we loved the crack. And, you know, we had a few drinks and had a little bit of a sing song, and it was great.
So I'm just thinking, actually, there's another name that I don't think has been mentioned yet. I think he was in that same squad. And it's someone who I actually feel, when I ever watched him play, was probably one of the most influential midfielders of that time. And I'm going to say Martin O'Neill. Yeah. I always enjoyed watching him play.
Martin had won 2 Champions League medals with Nottingham Forest when we went into that. He was our captain. He was our leader. And Martin was very astute. I mean, he knew the game inside out, and that's why he became such a successful manager as well. But Martin played in the middle of midfield alongside Sammy McElroy and David McCreary. And I played on the right-hand side of that trio and got myself forward whenever I could and joined in. And it was great coming from that position, because a lot of the defenders don't pick you up. And I was coming in unmarked, and that's why I ended up doing a lot of damage. Just scored three goals in the World Cup.
So what was it about that particular 82 side? I mean, obviously Northern Ireland had also got to the World Cup again in 86, but what was it about that 82 side that had got to the World Cup where hitherto it hadn't done for 20 years previously?
We won the British Championships in 1980. And that team was coming of age. Noel Brotherston and David McCreary and people like that, they were all coming through. We had a real experience in the back with Pat Jennings, you know, because when Pat went into the World Cup in 1982, I think he was 37 at the time. So he had experience and he was a brilliant goalkeeper and he gave us confidence and belief. Billy Bingham was the mastermind behind it all. He changed the team. He had John O'Neill playing most of the qualifying games. He played for Leicester, centre half. And John was playing there. But then when we went to train and we played the British Championships, Billy swapped it and made a few changes. And he wanted to see, you know, what Norman could do. And he wanted to see me in midfield. And he brought in John McClelland, who had a fantastic World Cup. He was at Rangers. And John was really quick, 6'2". He was quick. He covered the ground. We were a solid team. We didn't we conceded three goals in the qualifying stages for the 82 World Cup. That's all. And we were very, very solid at the back. And that, if you keep a solid base at the back and you've got people who can break away and score the odd goal and win matches and draw matches, then you're going to qualify. And that was the key. So a lot of reasons, but that we had a belief in ourselves. You know, we knew we were a good team and we were a good outfit and hard to beat.
So you mentioned Pat Jennings there. Have you ever seen his hair move? Does it move?
It's still the same.
He's got the same Barnett from 1972, hasn't he?
It is. It's incredible.
It's the same. It's the same.
I mean, I can't talk, but, you know. But, okay, well, what I want to do, I want to fast forward 4 years to 1986. And you were sat with your Northern Ireland team in Mexico. Young Steve Penny there as well. You got a phone call from a certain Alan Mullery.
I did. Alan phoned me and asked me what I was doing after the World Cup. And I said, I haven't picked a club yet. I've had a couple of offers and I was talking to different clubs. I'd actually had a run just before that at West Bromwich Albion. Johnny Giles had contacted me and I'd played there for several months. But then he left and I hadn't got a club. Chesterfield had, I played for John Duncan at Chesterfield. He wanted me to go back there. And I said, no, I'll wait and see what happens. And Alan phoned me, and obviously I was impressed. Loved Alan Mullery. He his pedigree, and as an ex-Spurs player as well, I wanted to join. So when I came back, I went down and met him down at Brighton and signed for Brighton and Hove Albion.
So was it? I mean, was it as simple as that? Did you need much arm twisting or?
Not really. No, I wanted to play. I wanted to play down on the coast, and I wanted to play for Alan Mullery. You know, he's the type of manager you want to play for.
Sure.
So that was the main reason I went down and the reason I signed. It was probably down to him. But it was good. I mean, Terry Connor was playing there at the time, myself. And we were going okay. We did okay at the start before Alan went.
That I mean, that was quite a front line, actually. I mean, it was yourself, Dean Saunders, Terry Connor, like you said. You had Steve Penny in there. There was a...
Steve Penny's your favourite, isn't he, Adrian? He's your...
Have we mentioned that before?
Once or twice. Well, actually, in that case, let's have his fellow countryman give him the once over. Give us your... Just so as we can please AD. Tell us about...
I know there's a few listeners to this who are also a big fan.
Yeah, I'm thinking of you, Karen. Yeah, Penny. So run the rule over you playing alongside Steve Penny.
Well, Steve was one of these skillful, tricky wingers, and he was exciting. When he got the ball, people got up off their seats because he was tricky. He'd run at you with pace and go inside and go outside, and he could put a good cross in. And, you know, he was a very talented player. Unfortunately, he got an injury, and that put paid to his career. But he was a very talented golfer, and he's still playing off scratch. At the moment, he plays golf probably two or three times a week over in Northern Ireland. I see Stephen now and again, keep in touch with him.
Sure.
He doesn't do anything else. It's all he does.
I know, just play golf. And isn't it something about cell central heating or something like that?
No, his wife got her Specsavers.
That's the one, yeah.
Franchise.
Yeah, so but Jerry... Okay,
this was Alan Mullery's second stint at the Albion, and it was, it's fair to say, was not as successful as his first, and he only actually lasted until January.
That's right. And we weren't bottom or middle of the table. We were sort of in the top six or seven in the table. We just, I think they sacked them after we beat Grimsby 2-1 away. And I think Terry Connor scored and I scored and we came back. But Gary O'Reilly, there's something to do with Gary O'Reilly there. I think he was sold to Crystal Palace to pay off whatever they needed to sell a couple of players.
Yeah.
And he was one of them that went. And the club wasn't in as good shape, obviously, as it is now. Let's put it like that. And I have to say to my mate, Tony Bloom, what a great job he's done.
Absolutely. You know? I want to come to that in a second. But the point is that the malaise, I think, probably largely started then. You know, I think they were just... Well, you were part of it. Well, us as fans from the outside... We realised that actually, probably with most fans and, you know, with most football clubs, there was this brick wall, there was this large moat between those who ran their football clubs and those who, you know, those who they're supporting it, who were their lifeblood. Now, obviously, relationships changed, certainly after Hillsborough and the fan movement kicked in and, you know, the intention of the increased dialogue between fans and clubs and every single club should know to talk to its fans. But back in those days, there was this, like I say, there was this shutter that just came down. And I think that level of mistrust, combined with the fact that you also had so many social problems associated with football, meant that you could see, certainly from our point of view, from the fans' point of view, a malaise starting. Now, obviously, you'd only just joined there, but, you know, you could see probably it wasn't the happy place, you know, of the club that you played 6-7 years previously that was going places compared to now. So give us a flavour of how you felt your time, your first impressions and those 3 years, you know, here.
It was crazy because there was rumours all the time. And a lot of the stuff that was said, I thought that can't be happening. But it was like Kieran O'Regan was one of the players. Kieran seemed to have an inside track to all the information. And he used to tell us on a Saturday what was happening. And then on the Monday, it would happen, you know. And I thought, what's going on? So there was unrest. And that caused problems within the players as well. Because when there's unrest, you know, the players are going to react to that. And, you know, I remember when I went on loan to Millwall for a couple of months. And I was playing for John Docherty and Frank McClintock. And that was after Barry had taken over, Barry Lloyd. Sure. And I think Barry was looking at Richard Tiltman and a couple of other players that he wanted to have a look at. But it didn't go well for the Albion at the time. Mm. And it went well for Millwall when I was playing there. I was playing up front with Teddy Sheringham, who was only 17 at the time. And I don't think we lost a game in the 8 games that I played. So I was looking at an option to go to Millwall when Barry contacted me, Barry Lloyd, and said, no, I need you back here. You know, we need you playing for us. So I came back to the Albion and I started playing again for the Albion. But we were on the road down. We were going to get relegated that season. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think the club, part of the club, maybe wanted to get relegated because they couldn't afford to keep a lot of the players and the bonuses and everything else. So I think that might have been part of the problem. And then the following year, Barry really got to grips with things and he started signing the Gary Nelsons. Mm-hmm. He signed the Kevin Bremners. He signed the Doug Ruvies. He signed a lot of good players. And the Dean Wilkinson. Yeah, Keith Dublin. There were some really, he made, well, his Chelsea connections, he made some very, very good signings. There was 5 or 6 really good signings that came in. And I could see the club change straight away. You could see the atmosphere was different. The camaraderie was good. And we were on the up. And, you know, I was coaching as well as playing. And occasionally he would say, oh, come with us to the game. And I'd be coaching the reserves and the youth team. And I would play in the reserves a lot of the time, but as a centre half. But then he'd say to me, oh, I need you to come with us this week. And then Martin Hinchwood would tell me, he said, oh, did you bring your boots? And I said, no, he didn't. He said, oh, he's going to put you on the bench tomorrow. You know, we were down at Oxford. So we were playing Oxford and he said, well, we'll borrow a pair of boots when we get up there. And I remember we got the Oxford and what do you call him? Brian was the manager of Oxford Brian at the Horton. Time. Brian Horton, ex-Albion. And I got there and I says, Brian, can you get me a pair of size 10s? And he said, what for? I says, I'm on the bench tomorrow. And he says, I'll get you. He said, you better not score with them though. So we were 2-1 down and I came on with 15 minutes and Barry said, "You need to get me a goal." So I remember running forward and the ball came into the box and I got on the end of it with a header and stuck in the back of the net. We drew 2-2. I said, "Well, I never used the boots."
Well, I was about to say, you didn't score with the boots, so that's all right. That's a nice...
So although Brian wasn't happy, Brian wanted to win. He was a winner. And but that sort of stuff. But there was great camaraderie and it was great fun. And I was learning coaching as well. So I started doing a bit of coaching as well as playing.
So the club that you'd actually moved to, you realised that actually it got better. I mean, did you sort of see any warning signs that when you got here, or did you think, actually, let's just see how this goes?
No, I didn't see any warning signs at first. It was a new club. I'm meeting new friends. You know, I was talking to the Chris Hutchinses and to the Gary Rowlett's and the Steve Gannings. And, you know, these are the people that were at the club longer than me and knew a bit more. And I was relying on them to give me the right information. So I didn't see any warning signs at all. And then all of a sudden, it just went bad. But sometimes you have to go backwards, like Tottenham when we got relegated, before you can move forward.
Sure.
So when you say about things going slightly awry, there was a Sussex Senior Cup game at Southwick. Which didn't end very well.
As AD is going through asking this, for those who haven't got super reverb vision, Jerry is grinning his ass off at the moment at this. Go on, Eddie. Sorry, finish your question, mate.
Well, it was a crazy situation. It always pops up and it always will pop up because nothing like that had ever happened before. And it was a situation where we're playing the Sussex Senior Cup and we drew Southwick and we played them at the Albion at Goldstone. And the match finished 1-1, but there was a lineswoman on the right-hand side, and I'm not saying it because she was a lineswoman, but the cross had come in, and the shot had come in. The goalkeeper made the save. He's on the ground, and the ball came back out, and then we've had a shot, and then the player pushed the ball around the post with his left hand, and the lineswoman gave a corner kick. She said, "No, it didn't cross the line," and I said, "No, it didn't cross the line, but it was the fullback saved it." So the referee was sort of looking to try and see, and he couldn't see, so he gave the corner kick. And it finished 1-1. So the replay was at Southwick. And I had quite a young side. I had a lot of, like, the Jack Dineens and people like that who were playing in the side. They were quite young. And the Ian Chapmans and what have you. And we went off to play Southwick at Southwick. And they were a very strong physical side. And it was a physical game. And I was asking the referee for protection for some of the younger players because technically we were much better than they were.
Sorry, can I just say, Jerry, is physical game a euphemism here?
Well, no, they were physical because they were big and strong, and they weren't technically as good as we were. We had a lot of 17 and 18 year olds who were very good and technically, so we could play them off the park, but. If you want to level things up, then you kick the players who are technically better than you. And I didn't feel the referee gave us as much protection as we should have had.
Right.
So I decided to sort a few of them out myself. And then I ended up getting sent off. Yeah. But then when I got sent off, it got worse because they ended up jumping into the crowd and hitting a couple of people in the crowd. And that was me. I remember the following day having to write my letter of resignation with Billy Bingham advising me. And then I wrote the letter of resignation, and that was the end of my career at the Albion.
Tim Carter describes it as a skirmish.
A skirmish, is it? Okay.
That's very good of him. Yeah, very good. Now, people always say to me about, you know, it was like a Cantona incident. And I said, well, it was. I said, the only difference was Cantona didn't draw blood. I drew blood, you know, so there was a big difference. There was a big difference, you know. But things like that happen in football. That's just another chapter in my career.
But you did hang around in Sussex for a while. I mean, you actually ended up playing for Southwick at one point. And
I did. Big Ray was a manager, and I played several games for them. And I keep in touch with some of the Southwick lads, you know. So, but I mean, I've still got association. Obviously, I was player manager at Worthing for 3 seasons, and that was very successful as well.
Great promotion. And you won the title, in fact.
Yeah, we were in the Conference League, and we turned it down, you know, which was disappointing for me because I'd worked hard to get us two promotions, you know. And once we went up, and then I turned down assistant manager's job for Northern Ireland with Brian Hamilton. And then when Bo Reynolds was the chairman at Worthing, he said, look, I don't think we can, financially we can afford to do it. He says, so we can't go into the conference. And I said, right, well, I'm going to pack it in, because I was working for Sky at the time and I wanted to go and become assistant manager with Brian Hamilton at Northern Ireland. And that's what I did do. And, but Live Worthing's going good again at the moment. They're sitting
They're
top
doing
of the
really
league.
Well,
it's,
yeah.
Yeah,
Really
they're
well.
Doing
actually,
well.
you actually mentioned his uncle earlier. Adam Hinshelwood's doing a fine job down there. And
He is.
and I got a feeling. Well, I was there on Saturday. It was a good game, 1-1 against
Yeah, that was
Hemel
Hemel.
Hempstead.
Hemel
Yeah,
Hempstead, yeah.
yeah. It was, I mean, to be honest, Worthing should have won and should have won out of sight. But they were very sloppy in front of the goal, and it was just one of those. Hemel had 5 minutes of decent football, scored their goal, and then Worthing just couldn't hit a cow's backside with a banjo after that. But you can see that the things are happening at Worthing. In very, very sort of bizarre ways that they're not at Southwick, but that's another matter entirely. And I hope that in this instance, if Worthing do have a good season and are invited into the conference, that they can actually have those facilities, because I fear, and I think that they've probably acknowledged this in the first place, I think I fear that, well, the cautionary tale, I think, in the 21st century is Lewis, that they couldn't afford to go in the conference, did, and it damn near bankrupted them. So, well, good luck to Worthing. But, I think there's
the conference,
a few
Al,
things. Sorry?
They are allowed to have the plastic pitch in the conference. But if they get promoted into the Football League, Sutton United did, and they have to rip up the plastic pitch.
Well, there's also that, but there's also the fact of one of their forms of income is being able to drink beer, and we still have this ridiculous draconian law that's been in place for the last 40 odd
years,
where apparently drinking beer turns you into a sort of a rampant savage, where it doesn't at football or when it doesn't at rugby or cricket. So, and that's something that Worthing would have to take into account. But yeah. kind of heady days for them at the moment.
Speaking of rampant savages, we've got Jerry Armstrong here.
Which, yes.
Very good, isn't he? Very good.
Yeah. Didn't seem to have to be quite so rude about our guest. Listen, we are very short of time here now. So just one last question, which we do ask our guests of note. We don't ask this of any old riffraff. We ask guests of note. Now, appreciate that your tenure at the Albion was short in comparison to the rest of your career, but obviously then you stayed on in Sussex. So as a message to our fans who are listening, or the Albion fans who are listening, what does Brighton and Hove Albion mean to you?
Well, after what the club's gone through over a lot of years and the highs and lows, when Tony Bloom took over, and I got to know Tony very well, and he took over, and he has transformed the club. I'm so pleased to see them, one, do so well, to get into top flight football, and now to qualify for European football. I do a lot of the European football here for Virgin Media, cover the Champions League, Europa League, Conference League, and I'm so pleased and really looking forward to seeing one of my old clubs, who I have a soft spot for, obviously participating and hopefully doing really well.
So in having you on all this time, we haven't actually asked you, what are you actually doing with yourself these days, Jerry?
Yeah, do a bit of commentary work and analysis with Virgin Media in Dublin. And, I get myself 3 or 4 little gigs every year. I've got a book out at the moment called Jerry Armstrong, my Journey, My Story. And I'd love to get over to the Albion at some stage in the future and maybe do a day down at the club shop. But and I also have a whiskey coming out in the next couple of weeks,
whiskey,
which is called Spirit of 82. Yeah,
fantastic.
An Irish whiskey. Yeah,
I can think of a few places that might want to stock that.
It's very good. I have to say, I'm really pleased with the whiskey. The whiskey is very good. So it was built in, or sorry, it's made in the Titanic Brewery in Belfast, and we're pleased with it.
Okay. Well, I mean, obviously, Jerry, I know you come from the other side of the border, but you obviously work in Dublin. Now, obviously, there's a young Brighton player who's causing a lot of shockwaves around the continent at the moment, and that is young Evan Ferguson. So what's the feeling in Dublin about Evan and how far he can go?
They love him down here, obviously, and they're disappointed that he wasn't able to play in the last 2 big games, which they lost. But Evan's a promising player. He's got all the potential in the world. A lot of people here look upon him. I see him as a Teddy Sheringham come Harry Kane type player. And he's going to score goals. He's only going to get better. I hope his career is long and fantastic. And he scores many, many goals for the Albion and many goals for the Republic of Ireland.
I mean, just sorry, I just want to one more. Obviously, when you see that, and you just say scoring a lot of goals from the Albion, obviously we see a lot of stuff in the media. Everyone's trying to sell him off already. Do you see that as being disrespectful to Brighton?
It is, I think, and Brighton should just snub them straight away. I mean, the young lads came through the ranks. He's getting better, and suddenly he's really up the fore, and everybody's talking about him. But I'd love to see the Albion keep him there and hold on to him and let him develop. And he's obviously settled at the club. He's loving playing his football. He's not just a goal scorer. This is what I was saying. He's got vision. He's a good passer of the ball. He creates chances for other players. There's more to him than that. And I think he's only going to get better. So let's see what he does over the next 3 or 4 years. And hopefully it's all good.
Absolutely. Well, if only he's as good as you, Jerry. But that is all we've got time for this week. So thank you so much to our special guest, Jerry Armstrong. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been AD Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast, and in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Hopefully we see you at the Hope and Ruin on Sunday. Thanks for listening. See you later. Bye.
ocean, and some men like the violin, and some men like to hear a cannonball rolling. But me, I like sleeping, especially in my Molly's chamber. But here I am in prison, here I am with a bomb.